This week on Beyond the Thesis with Papa PhD, I have the great pleasure of bringing you a treasure from the vault all the way back from season one of the Papa PhD podcast. My conversation with Fiona Robinson about her journey from her PhD to her postdoc to her freelance career in the medical editing space. Fiona shares a lot of great insights during this conversation, so be sure to have pen and paper and to take note of all the nuggets she shares around getting career clarity after the PhD or after your postdoc. And now, enjoy the episode. Welcome to Beyond the Thesis with Papa PhD, the podcast that delves into the diverse and impactful roles scientists can play beyond the lab, with me, David Mendez. So today, I'll be talking with Fiona Robinson. Following a PhD in RNA biochemistry at Cambridge University and postdoc in developmental neurobiology and oncology at the Toronto Hospital for Sick Children, Fiona moved to Montreal and shifted careers into science communications and medical education. Fiona, welcome to the podcast. Now I'll let you tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to speak with you. So when you contacted me and asked me to talk a little bit about my career progression from graduate studies to what I do now, I was very enthusiastic to do so because I remember, going through some phases where I really had no idea what direction to go in and didn't feel very confident. And I have to say that I've kind of landed somewhere where I am actually really very happy. And I would like people to know that, that's a very probable outcome. When I was doing my research, working as a PhD student and as a postdoc and even as a research associate, I really did enjoy the bench work. I enjoyed writing. I really enjoyed the writing part of it. I found myself often helping other people with their communications in the lab, editing theses and papers or helping students to prepare for their committee meetings. But I didn't see a long-term future for me in research, really. And I was sort of disappointed because it's what I'd wanted to do for a long time. And I did stick at it for quite a long time. But I also found that I was finding a lot more fulfillment in some of the things that I was doing outside of the lab. And just because I'm naturally somebody who looks to settle into a community when I move, and I moved around quite a bit during my studies, every time I went to a new city, I would do two things. I would find a hockey team to play on, and I would go to the volunteer center and find somewhere to volunteer. And those two things ended up really being, I think, key to the direction I ended up taking. Because a lot of the volunteer things that I did were around science communication and medical education, and not even necessarily by design. Those were just the opportunities that leapt out at me when I would go to those volunteer centers. I joined an HIV/AIDS education group in Cambridge, and soon found myself giving classes in the high school about viruses. And I joined a group called Sci-Hi in Toronto that did hands-on demonstrations of science to either schools or community groups. And I started volunteering also as an editor on a journal called Hypothesis, which was an open access online journal that had been started by a group of graduate students. And so I just found myself often going in the same direction and really enjoying that work. And when I moved to Montreal, and my partner and I moved to Montreal for personal reasons, I decided to just sort of as an experiment try continuing to look for research positions, but also looking for opportunities in the science communication, medical education field, and just see which one opened up first. And it was the direction that I ended up going in. It was a science communication side of things. And I really built up a passion for wanting science and knowledge of science to serve society. And, I think a lot of us do research because we want to serve society. We want the research results to benefit the public. We want things to be better for people with a certain illness, or we want to improve outcomes in some area as a result of our research. And so I think there's a few ways that can happen. One is by advancing the research, but the other is by communicating it well to people and people understanding it. And that's where I felt that there was a lot of opportunity and a lot of breakdown, where the headlines that you see in the papers don't always reflect the research that's being done. And it ends up, I think, with a society that maybe doesn't feel really confident or familiar with science, and they don't always see it as a positive thing. And so I was always kind of interested in trying to impact that and empower people with science. So while I was doing my PhD, I was at Cambridge, and I was on a pretty small personal stipend. And so to make ends meet, I worked as a cleaning lady. So I would go to this lady's house for a couple of hours per week and clean her house. And she was a very smart lady. She had already a PhD in one field and was getting a second degree in another. But she hired me because she had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And she found that with all that, cleaning the house as well was too much. And I liked it because it was a chance to just switch my brain off and just do something manual. And quite often, while I was writing my thesis, some of my best ideas of how to bring the data together came while I wasn't thinking about it. But so one evening, I was literally scrubbing the toilet, and she came to me with this package insert from her medication. And she said to me, "Can you understand this? Because tomorrow I have to decide if I'm going to continue taking this drug or not. And I don't understand what this says." And it was, you know, the list of prescribing information and potential adverse events and that sort of thing. And I thought two things at that point. I thought, one, if her best resource at this point for that information is her cleaning lady, there's a problem with the system. She's not getting the information she needs. And the second thing I realized was that that's what I want to do. I want to use my ability to analyze information like that, research maybe some background around it, and use what's available to help patients make the right decisions for them. I didn't know anything about multiple sclerosis at that time, particularly. I was doing RNA splicing in my PhD, but I could find out what she needed to know to understand what she was trying to read and to make the decision that was best for her. And so it was sort of in that moment with the toilet brush in hand that I was like, this is what I want to do. I had no idea what that looked like. I had no idea if that even existed. You know, I was like, is there such a job? Is it? And it took me 10 years to find that position. I finished my PhD. I went on and did a postdoc because I did like the research. I went from that on to being a research associate. But that had really sparked in me something that, you know, I felt like there was something else that I could do with this, with the abilities I developed as a researcher. And in fact, when we came to Montreal, I started working in medical education. And I worked in a couple of different positions. And when I saw the description for the job that I do now, I was lit up. I was, this is my job. That's what I've been looking for the last 10 years. And I applied for it, and I went for the interview. And it was sort of funny, in the interview, they were saying, "Do you have any questions?" And I said, "Not really, but it's not because I don't want to know. It's because I do know. I know this is the job that I want." And they said it was quite convincing. So. But it's quite amazing because, you know, I think maybe that's an important takeaway, is that you don't have to know exactly what your job looks like or what it is or what its title is. You have to kind of know what your passion is, what you'd like to be able to do, what you feel like you can do, and then you start looking around for it. And you may not get to it directly. I think in academia, we kind of get used to a very linear progression. You do your bachelor's, and then you do your graduate, and then you do your postgraduate, and then you know, it's very kind of linear, and it's unidirectional, and it's pretty much predefined. If you step out of that, you have to embrace a certain amount of uncertainty. You don't know necessarily where you're going, but in some ways that's liberating. So, for example, your first job out of academia is very unlikely to be your lifetime job, if such a thing even exists anymore. You know, not outside of academia, not that many people start a job when they finish their education and stay in it for the rest of their career. There's a lot of changes in direction and focus and, you know, maybe complete change of career. So when I came, my first job in outside of academia, I knew when I took it that I didn't want to do that forever. But it did give me some really good experience getting into the kind of science communication area and also showing employers that I could work in a non-academic environment. Because that's really important. Non-academic employers can be quite reluctant to hire people who've been in academia for a while. They have some kind of impression that we're unsociable and not players and not necessarily manageable and bookish and kind of stuck in the ivory tower. And it's important to have something to show, something for them to take a look at and say, okay, I think this person has some social skills. I think this person could be part of a team. So that's where things like having played hockey in different places and being involved in various volunteer activities, it also showed them that I had a life outside of the lab work and that I was capable of working with other people and that I even had an inclination to do that. But those were things, again, that I did because I enjoyed them. But I think they ended up being a real positive in terms of, you know, showing a potential corporate employer or non-academic employer that I could be part of their team.
And that you were a multifaceted person and potential employee.
Yeah, for sure. I think that was important. It was also really important to me in terms of just being healthy as a whole individual during my studies. I tried going maybe one semester without playing hockey. And I realized that I didn't feel well at all. I needed to play hockey. You know, I only play at a very low level in a recreational league. But for me, it's really important. It's where I find other women who are like me. You know, we play recreational hockey. We don't take ourselves too seriously. We have a good laugh. We do something sporty. That proved to be essential for me.
So what I'm understanding here is that you always gave importance, and tell me if I'm interpreting right, to having a balance between your work life, in this case, you know, study, be it PhD or postdoc, but also then extracurricular activities. But what I find very interesting is that I feel that you found this calling, which was to get scientific knowledge to everyone or as many people as possible. But what you did was always find a way to nurture this this side of your interests with the volunteering.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to admit that I wasn't so good at the balancing earlier on. I mean, as an undergraduate, anyone who knew me as an undergraduate would probably say that I was far too often in the library and not often, you know, out in the bars. But that was something I had to kind of mature into, I think, and I got better at it as I went further through my studies. And I think it also became more necessary for me. Up to a certain point, I was prepared to keep my head down and my nose to the bench and just keep working for that academic career. But also over time, I just realized that it wasn't doing it for me. So branching out, getting out and volunteering and doing other things just became essential for me. And like I said, in a number of cases, that was more fulfilling than what was going on in the lab for me. Even though I liked the bench research and I liked the research, it was very hard to see a long-term future in it. It became clear to me reasonably early on that I wasn't likely to become a professor. And so then any kind of sort of long-term stability, it was hard to see how that was going to happen.
Yeah. Excellent. So, and given that you had this, you know, that you felt that the academic path was not going to be fulfilling for you long term. How did that impact, you know, your graduate milestones, like writing up your PhD or going through your postdoc? Did it pose obstacles? Was it easy for you to, you know, to finish each chapter, let's say, of your graduate and postgraduate studies? How did this knowledge that you wanted to follow something else impact, you know, the final stages of, let's say, your PhD and even your postdoc?
So I have to say that I was in the final year of my PhD for at least 18 months. And so that is, I think that might be an experience other people have as well, where it takes a while to finish, and it's not the most fun time. It's stressful, and you wonder how you're going to get through it. I was pretty motivated to finish because, I mean, I did like the research. I loved writing. So I actually am one of those weirdos who enjoyed writing their thesis. You know, there was a very high time pressure on, so that was kind of less pleasant. But I really, when I could actually just sit and write, I liked doing that. And I was very motivated. I knew I wanted to postdoc, so I was very motivated to finish up and go on and postdoc. But it was more during my postdoc that I kind of lost steam because I just didn't see it going anywhere really promising. And that was when I had to really think hard about what to do. And unfortunately, I think also in academia, there's not a lot of mentoring around that kind of reflection. And so I was very lucky to have a good friend. We actually did our PhDs both in Cambridge and then ended up both postdocing at SickKids in Toronto. And Mariana Vargas Caballero, and she would sit with me, and we would have these long chats over lunch. And you know, she knew what she wanted to do. She wanted to do the research. She is doing research now. She's very successful, does really good research, and she's managed to balance it out. She's got a beautiful family. But she really helped me to realize that we're responsible for our own happiness. No one is going to come along and figure these things out for you, and it's nobody's job to do so. I think sometimes we feel like we've just got to suffer through things when we're in academia, and somehow there's merit in that. And in fact, there's not really. You get one shot at life. If you're not enjoying it, it's nobody's problem but your own. And the opportunity and the responsibility to do anything about it is also uniquely your own. And, you know, she really helped me to reflect on that. And it was sort of funny because she did not encourage me to leave academia, not at all. But she helped me to see that that's what I wanted to do. And so, you know, she kind of really helped me to start looking for those other opportunities. And it started with, instead of doing a second postdoc, because you can just go on forever with the postdocs, becoming a research associate instead. And that gave me an opportunity to be in a slightly different position in the lab. I really enjoyed that. And I would have, if when we came to Montreal, if an opportunity like that would have worked out for me, I would have taken it and gone in that direction, I think. But it happened that funding schemes changed right about the time I came to Montreal, and a couple of labs that wanted to hire me due to administrative rules couldn't, because they couldn't put that kind of money to a research associate. And so, it kind of just, circumstances conspired that the opportunity to work, my first position outside of academia was working to create public education posters that you'd see sometimes in pharmacies and doctors' waiting areas. And they're sponsored by a pharma company, but they're strictly educational. There's no promotion to them because they know that the more certain conditions are diagnosed, the more of their particular product will be prescribed. So that was a great opportunity for me because it gave me a chance to just change completely, go into the office environment, work in a team, work for a non-academic employer, work with budgets, timelines, clients. And they were interested in me because I had worked with science education outside of the lab. All those things I had done outside of the lab just because I was interested, they got me in the door for an interview. Now, I also should mention that it took about a year to get that. So I started looking for work in January. I'm still in Toronto. We moved to Montreal in the summer. And in the fall, I was looking 100%. All of my time was spent looking for a job. And it was December before I got a job. And that was rough. That was really hard. You look at yourself and you think, you know, I've got a PhD, I'm a pretty smart person, got all kinds of skills, and I can't even get an interview. It was pretty demoralizing. But it was worth it because, you know, the first interview that I got the job, and it was a fantastic opportunity to learn all of those things and prove that I could do all of those things. And I stayed there for less than a year. Within a year, I had kind of gotten what I could out of the job. But I also now had a CV that showed that I could do this kind of work. And it so happened that my goalie in my hockey team was working for a company that was doing something similar, but on a much more advanced level. And so when I went to them with my CV via her, which really helped to have that connection, they looked at what I was doing, but they also looked back at my previous work. I remember sitting in the interview for that position and they said, oh, wait, you've edited a journal, which was something I'd done as a volunteer. Well, that's interesting. And maybe we should bring you on as a junior editor then. And so that was what gave me an opportunity to go, again, a little further, do things that were more challenging, pick up more skills, really develop, rather than just making sort of short posters for display. I was learning how to make e-learning modules and interactive PDFs and on-site, in-person training workshops. And so that was fantastic. That really expanded my repertoire of what I could manage. Because a big part of that kind of work as well is actually project management. I mean, officially I was a medical editor, but you're also managing a lot of the project and you're working with an entire team of writers and graphic artists and coordinators. And so that whole side of it, it's a whole lot of social skills and organizational skills. And while I think you develop at least the organizational skills in the lab, again, showing that you've got those social skills, they often come outside of the lab. And that's something else that I think it's worth thinking about, because when we're in the lab, we tend to think that we only know the kind of information that we know, and we forget about all the other things that we develop as researchers. I think, for me, research, the thing that I've seen that I think is the biggest transferable skill out of research is the ability to take a big problem, a big question, break it down into smaller parts, and evaluate those. What do I need to tackle each of those? How can I do it? Who do I need? What's the timeline on that? Do they have to be done in a certain order? Execute them, and then bring them back together into one big thing. That's what research is, right? That's also event planning. That's also if you want to take an idea and build it up to a publication, developing a product and launching it, like anything like that. Those are exactly the skills you need. And the management consulting companies in the UK used to come and recruit from the life science PhD programs at Cambridge and Oxford. And we would always say to them, "But why? Like, we don't have any business knowledge." And they said, "Well, you're literate, you're numerate, and you can do problem solving, critical thinking. That's what we need. We can teach you to write." And I think that's the case for so much of research. We have all of those skills, and it's not everybody who has, you know, really refined those skills. So if you find something else you're interested in and you start applying that kind of rigorous method to it, you probably find that you're pretty good at it.
Yeah, definitely. And in long term, you know, in projects that could take, you know, years, a master's could be 2 years, but a PhD can be 6-7. And so, you know, you're not going to be intimidated by, you know, regular, 6-month projects at whichever job that you're working at. So Fiona, yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. You come out of grad school and even of a postdoc with a huge amount of stamina, you know, resilience to take on very, very challenging projects, and this is often very interesting, an interesting set of skills for employers. For employers that are, you know, looking for candidates with the profile of either master's or PhD graduates. Now, you seem to, you know, you kind of told, you've kind of gone over a whole arc of your story from undergrad to grad school. You've talked about the importance sports had, and specifically hockey, had keeping you sane and healthy throughout. Same thing with volunteering and finding ways to give back to the community. I find it very, very important. Giving back is to me one of the most effective ways to get back to recharge your almost your spiritual batteries. I don't know if you would agree. And it seems to me that throughout all of this, you've always kept a positive attitude. And this links to my next question, which is, what main attitude or principle would you say has accompanied and guided you from that turning point of that aha moment of knowing what you wanted to do later on to today? And how has this attitude impacted your life up till today?
It's a good question. And I think I would not have been able to put my finger on it at the time. But looking back, I think it's a combination of maybe two things. One is that realization that it's really up to you to be responsible for your own happiness. But that's really something that, you know, whoever you are, whatever you're doing, we can't control the things that are around us or the circumstances that we're in. But we also can't just sit back and say, well, I'm unhappy with this. You know, someone else should do something about it. No one will. It's really up to us. We have the responsibility. We also have the opportunity, the freedom to do something about it. And I think it's sort of that combined with, like you say, we learn when we do research, or maybe we're drawn to research because we naturally do work really hard at things, but sometimes only progress incrementally. And, you know, we have that stamina to stick with it. And I think that that's really valuable. You know, I'm on the one hand, I'm saying, I really see the value in seeing if you're not happy in something and looking for ways to move on. But at the same time, that idea that you work hard at something and sometimes it isn't easy going, but you know that it's going towards something that, that is going to be rewarding or that you believe in, I think that's one of the driving forces that, that keeps us going. And the other thing that I'm very involved in here in Montreal is volunteering with the Women's Hockey Organization community. And there I had the opportunity to work with some of the best female hockey players in the world, some of the Olympic stars. And I've always been a geek. I've never been a sporty person. I play hockey, but at the lowest possible level. And I kind of assumed that these women were just naturally really good at hockey. And they are, but they work so hard. Working with them, I've had the opportunity to see that same commitment that we apply in research. They're applying to improving their skills in hockey, whether it's in the gym or on the ice or in off-ice training or in video review. They are just working so hard and demanding so much of themselves. And I think that really inspires me. I see them going for excellence and pushing themselves in order to achieve excellence, but still enjoying it. It's the thing that they love. I mean, they barely get paid anything, so they really are doing it for the love of the game. And that inspired me as well to seek opportunities to live that myself. So the work that I do now, you know, I could probably make a lot more money working in a pharmaceutical company. But I would not get the same joy out of what I do as I do now. And sometimes there are frustrations that go along with that. You don't have the same resources, or maybe there's politics. There's politics everywhere. But I get so much joy out of seeing that the work I do is actually bettering the lives of some people with, in this case, bleeding disorders. I meet them sometimes. I see them using the resources that I've created and developed with the other volunteers of the organization. With the help of the volunteers of the organization. And it's just so rewarding that it's worth the work that you put into it. And it's worth holding oneself to a very high standard to make sure that we're producing really, really good materials. And I think that it's a combination of that drive for excellence, but that patience and that maturity that you know that you have to break them down into smaller components, and you have to work through them with the resources you have available to do the best that you can. And I think that's something that you can apply to any area of interest, any kind of work.
Yeah, and just going back a little bit to finishing, you know, some of our listeners may be finishing or maybe trying to decide whether they'll write up their master's thesis instead of going to the PhD. And, you know, that last stretch may be challenging. And you told me off the mic about one of your latest sports exploits. And I feel that it aligns pretty well with what our listeners can be experiencing right now. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do, yeah, for sure. It's funny. I think, yeah, it's an interesting parallel to draw. So as I alluded to in my biography, I'm very recently a half Ironman. In that I completed the half Ironman at Mont Tremblant in June of this year. And for me, that was a huge challenge. I'm not an actually athletic person. I've done a couple of smaller triathlons, but nothing like it. And when I signed up for it about a year ago, I was physically incapable of 1900 meters and then biking 90 kilometers in the hills of Mont Tremblant and then running a half marathon, 21.1.
Oh, that's pretty impressive.
it was pretty daunting. I signed up for it thinking, oh my God, how am I going to do this? But it was great to have the focus and the challenge and, you know, to apply kind of that similar mindset of, I really want to do this. And I guess maybe that's the biggest parallel to getting through that versus getting through completing your degree. I want to do it for me. That was my big motivation. I wanted to do it for me. I knew I wasn't going to beat much of anybody. I wasn't into trying to make a podium or, you know, finish it. I just wanted to do it for me. It doesn't get me anything, right? Having done a half Ironman is not a qualifying skill for really anything. But I just wanted to set myself a goal that was outside of my current limit and do it. And it was challenging, and it was sometimes extremely, you know, it's 30 below and you're going for a run on Mont-Royal Saturday morning. It wasn't the most tempting thing to do. But it actually, every little achievement along the way, you know, every little run done, every swim done, every biking done, it was just, it was a little reward all along the way. And the camaraderie of the group that I was training with, a fantastic triathlon club here in Montreal called The Chicken, who are so patient, so encouraging. And then to do it on the day, you know, it took me 7 hours. It's quite a long time. It was better than I was expecting. I was worried I wouldn't be able to do it within eight. And, you know, the last couple of kilometers, I felt like throwing up. But at the same time, it was just so exhilarating to be like, I can do this. I'm going to have done this. And so at that point, and I think that is similar to when you're writing up at the end, you know, you just got to get through it. You just kind of owe it to yourself just to get through it. You've worked so hard. You've put in so many difficult hours, and you've often given up all kinds of things to get yourself there. So no matter what anyone else thinks, no matter what anyone else, you know, is encouraging you to do or not to do for yourself, you need to finish that thing, and then you've got it forever. You can always say, I did that. And, you know, I think a master's or a PhD, it's going to make a difference. It's going to give you an opportunity on your CV and your future career opportunities that a half Ironman won't. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't magically open doors. But it, I think in both cases, you've kind of made a deal with yourself. You're kind of also telling yourself that, you know, this is all worth it. Like, I've done something and I can be proud of it. And I think that's also just an important personal reckoning that I did this for me and I did it and it's done. And then you can decide to move on to other things if you want to. And that PhD or master's on your CV, even if it doesn't, you may not get a job in something that's directly related to it, but smart employers will recognize the discipline and the effort that it took and the intelligence that it took to get that degree, regardless of the topic. That's always going to be a good set of qualifications to have.
And tell me if you agree. I have a feeling that even psychologically, the fact of finishing, be it the PhD or the half Ironman, the fact that you finished allows you to consider going further the next time. It's kind of a boost to your ego almost. I finished. Now this is behind me and I can move further and go higher.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, prior to doing the half Ironman, I did a marathon. And 2 years before that, I would have said, I could never run a marathon. I couldn't do that. And then I decided I wanted to do it and I trained for it and I did it very slowly, but I did it. And then after that, I thought, well, what else could I do? And I started thinking about, you know, the half Ironman. And when I signed up for it again, I was like, oh God, I don't know if I could do that. But I did it. And so then you kind of get in the habit of breaking your limits, of pushing past your limits. And that is incredibly empowering. And it translates to, I think, your office work or whatever else you're doing. I don't think that it's any coincidence. Well, okay, this may be a coincidence, but I think it's related that, you know, when I started to push myself to really get more fit and to take on these sorts of challenges, that's also when I started moving towards the job that I have now, that I really enjoy more than the other jobs I had out of research. I think that when this job came along, I had the confidence in myself to go for it, partly because I had already taken on other things that I thought might be outside of my abilities or outside of my limits and achieved them. So I thought, well, why not? I can go for this as well. And I think it really does impact your overall confidence and self-esteem. And those are also things that are really, they're really transferable. They make you a much easier person to work with. If you can feel confident about yourself and you're not constantly seeking validation or doubting yourself and kind of, you know, putting that onto other people. And I think you're easier to work with and you're maybe better at your job when you can come with more positivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. And what I'm taking from what you're saying is, first, even if you want to leave the academic career path, having a master's or a PhD on your CV is not going to be discounted by whoever is going to be interviewing you for jobs. It counts. It's not lost time. Second, I'm getting also this this feeling that, you know, if you're at the end, if you're you know, 1 year to your defense, just take the energy that you have, put it all into your resilience and finish, because it's going to be hard, but what you're going to take home from it is going to be exponentially more.
I think so. I think you owe it to yourself, and it's got to be for yourself. It can't be for anybody else because someone else is obliging you to do it, or you feel like you owe it to someone else. You owe it to yourself. And I think that's kind of the biggest motivator to get through something like that is that you're doing it for yourself. It's true that I think some employers are intimidated by some higher studies. I've known people to take the PhD off their CV because they think it improves their employability. I don't know about that. I don't know. I have been in situations where I think that my PhD has made people uncomfortable. And that's kind of too bad. I do believe, though, for example, the job that I have now, you don't need a PhD. On paper, you do not need a PhD or think even a master's to get the job. However, I think I do a much better job of it because of the higher studies that I've done. And not just because of the knowledge that I gained about, you know, biology, but because of all those other skills, all the critical thinking and the project management, all of those skills, I think those are probably at least as important as the scientific knowledge I picked up along the way. So, you know, whether every employer is going to be delighted to see it or not on your CV, you as an individual are better able to succeed at whatever you take on because of the skills that you pick up while you're doing your graduate study. And if you're close to finishing, I really think you owe it to yourself to finish and then to celebrate that.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, like you were talking about your interview for your current position, I guess also if you manage to get an interview or even an informal meeting with someone at an employer that you really want to work for, if you're well prepared, you're going to be able to convince them and to show them that you are not just your PhD. And I felt that that's something that happened in your interview process.
For sure. And I think even from the first interview that I got outside of academia, I think from that first time that I was able to present myself in person, you could see the difference. Like I'd been sending CVs out and not getting interviews. But when I managed to get in for an interview, I got straight into the job. And, you know, so much of it is about showing who you are and what your personal motivation is, your enthusiasm for what you want to do there. And that it should come through in your CV and in your letter. So, for example, if I apply for a position somewhere, I will take my CV and I will customize it to that position. So it's got all the same basic content in it, but I might change up the headings or I might change the order. I might reword the objective. And the cover letter as well should be absolutely tailor written to the position, saying why you are the one for that job, why you want to do that job. And it should, you know, I think we kind of think people will read our CV and see all these things that are so obviously relevant to their position. No, people who are doing a first reading of CVs, they have so little time for CV, they see almost nothing. You want to put in that cover letter, I am good for this job because I've done this, this, and this, and I want to do this job because I'm personally motivated by this, 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 this. If you hope people are going to discover that for themselves in your CV, you know, you're asking too much. You've got to really put it up there. And it doesn't take a lot to do that, but it's worth it. And then if you get the chance to meet them in person and talk to them, you bring all your enthusiasm and your personal ability and you show it. And that goes a long way. That goes further than, you know, underlying knowledge.
So we're talking about promoting yourself. Did you have access to services at university that helped you tailor your CV, prepare for interviews, or was this something that you had to go about on your own?
I was actually really lucky in a way. I did a co-op undergraduate degree back when they were not actually that common. I went to the University of Guelph and I studied biochemistry in their co-op education program. And that meant that after the first year or so of studies, every second semester, I worked full-time somewhere. And so we got coached in preparing our CVs for that. So I had a job with Mark Frost here in Montreal, I had a job with Boehringer Ingelheim, who were at the time at V-Omega in Laval. And so that gave me also an exposure to working outside of the academic environment. But also that I got a chance to work on a CV, go through interviews. They had this horrible thing that they did, which was a really good idea. It was just awful, mortifying to do, where they videotape you doing a mock interview, and then you have to watch yourself.
Yeah. I've been through something like that too, and it's awkward, but it is useful.
But it's really helpful, yeah. It's really, really helpful. So I think that helped, and that was a long time ago in my undergraduate. There wasn't so much of that during graduate school, and I think I've said it before, that during your graduate studies, you're not really encouraged to consider things other than that academic route. I mean, even during my PhD, I was part of a small group of students that organized seminars. I think it was every Friday afternoon or every couple of Friday afternoons, we'd have somebody speak. And usually it was a student speaking about their research so that we would get better doing that. But then every once in a while, we'd bring in someone who'd done a life sciences PhD and who was doing something different now. And it was super interesting. We had one lady who was an advisor to a law firm. So if the law firm was involved in litigation around a drug, she could advise them about the whole biochemistry side of how the drug worked. So we had all these different people who'd come in and speak like that. And I got labeled in the department as not being very serious about my research because I was organizing these things, even though I was committed to going and doing a postdoc and at the time, you know, thought I wanted to be a professor. Just the fact that I showed an interest and kind of helped to provide opportunities for other people to explore those possibilities, no, that was frowned upon. And I think that's really unfortunate because, I mean, you all know the pyramid of the academic system. All of these people coming through as PhDs and postdocs are not all going to become professors. And many aren't suited to it, and many have got so many skills and would be so good in so many other things. We should encourage that exploration. And I think that for some reason, that doesn't happen very much.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. Actually, it's funny, we had never thought about that stage of your academic life, but you were like Papa PhD before Papa PhD.
Yeah, sort of.
Very cool. It is sad, but the good news is that there are now, I'm thinking of McGill, for example. There's a Careers and Placement Center where there are people that are dedicated to helping you find your way. You have CV tailoring workshops. There's career fairs that are organized now and then. So I think, you know, maybe it depends on where you are, but for sure these resources exist and people can, at the university, find help transitioning. And that's
fantastic.
Good.
And I think it's great that that's happening. And I hope that people feel comfortable to do so. Because again, it's up to you. You've got to go looking for yourself. You've got to go see what interests you. The other thing that I did late during my PhD, and I do it every once in a while when I start to feel restless, is I look at job postings that are out there, not with the intention of applying for them, but just kind of either physically or digitally kind of scrapbooking them. You know, cut it out, put it in an envelope if it looks vaguely interesting. And then at some point, pull them out and look at them and say, well, what have I collected? Because honestly, a lot of the time you think, well, maybe I don't want to do research, but I don't know what I want to do. But if you just, and it's a lot of pressure to think, well, I've got to pick now. I'm going to go in this direction. But if you just kind of, every time you see something that looks kind of interesting, just snag it, put it in an envelope somewhere, and then pull them out at some point and be like, okay, have I got a concentration of something? And so I was kind of doing that. And I think then also the volunteering was my other way of doing that without even realizing that's what I was doing. And then you start to see the things that are drawing you. And, you know, there was a colleague that I had when I was doing my PhD who he was really involved in organizing the May Ball. It's a Cambridge tradition because in May, everyone is so busy with exams, you basically miss the month of May, which is beautiful in England. Which is, you know, it's one of the really lovely months. So in June, you have a May ball, which is just kind of make up for having this entire month. You finished your exams, and so you just party all night. You start at about 7 p.m. and you party until sort of breakfast. And it's, you know, full on Cambridge. So you're in your tuxes and gowns, and there's champagne, and it's the full thing. There's fireworks. So it's a massive event. And so he was really involved in organizing that with some people in his college. And I remember his supervisor saying something about him pursuing his alternate career in event. And it was kind of said kind of half as a joke, kind of not. And I, to be honest, I'm not even sure what he went on to do as a career. He could have done anything he wanted, I think. But that kind of came back to me. And I was thinking about this, like, yeah, the skills we use in the lab to do our research, they're so transferable to things like running events and anything where you've got to organize a lot of things, a lot of components. And if you look at what you're doing in your spare time or what you wish you were doing in your spare time, you may very well find something that you could pursue as a career, and you could start to dabble in maybe as a volunteer or getting involved in some societies or organizations. You also start to make contacts that way. They can write reference letters for you. When I applied to the job that I have now, where I'm working for a not-for-profit, one of my key letters of reference came from the GM of Le Canadien Montréal, the women's hockey team. They're part of the CWHL, which is a not-for-profit league. And I spent 9 years volunteering for them with increasing amounts of responsibility and a big team of volunteers under me. And so I could go to this organization and say, I've worked for a not-for-profit. I know what it is to follow the mission. Mm-hmm.
I know the culture.
Exactly. Work with teams of volunteers. That's a very particular set of skills. And not only do I have those skills, I have someone who will tell you, someone who's in a position of recognized authority, who will tell you that you're good at this. So, you know, it started out as something I was doing just because I liked hockey. But it ended up being actually really important to the advancement of my career to where I am now.
Mm-hmm. And if we go back to university, grad school, and postdoc, are there also people from that sphere that still today have are somehow important in your network that had an impact on the job you have now, or is university and your current career, are they like two separate compartments?
I don't think they have to be two separate compartments. I think in my case, they mostly are. Unfortunately, I didn't really have mentors within academia. And there was never really somebody that I felt really connected to and that I felt really cared about my outcome. Like I said, there was a fellow student and postdoc who was someone who really, really supported me and helped me and that I felt really comfortable with and who helped me to value my own happiness.
Mm-hmm. I was actually going to ask you about that. So you talked about this person who helped you kind of reflect and then stop having the tunnel vision that you may fall into when you're in the academic career track, let's say. But there was no one that was playing the role of mentor that you could go and open your heart to about your doubts and your questions at the time.
No, unfortunately not. I have to say that really throughout my academic career, from undergraduate all the way through, there wasn't really somebody. I had a guidance counselor as an undergraduate who cared, I think, quite a bit, eventually retired. But from graduate school on, we were really just left to fend for ourselves, I think. And it was sort of hoped that he would figure things out. And yeah, I felt pretty much on my own in that respect. And even quite frustrated, because sometimes I would go to these seminars about, finding your way or at the time I was really hoping to make it in academia and wanting to research it. But they'd have somebody who got a Nature paper in their master's and then went on to star in their PhD, and then they got the top postdoc and off they went to become a professor. And that's not really helping me, because the individuals who find themselves in that situation or who work themselves into that situation, however you want to look at it, I think you're getting a lot of guidance and mentorship from their professors, because professors love these superstars and doors are open for them and they're getting lots of encouragement. It's the people like me who didn't get the Nature paper out of their PhD, didn't have that obvious stellar pathway. I think sometimes we just get left to our own devices, which is unfortunate. I mean, graduate studies are still an education. They're not just a data generation vehicle for your professor. And sometimes I feel like that gets a bit neglected, just as I don't think the ability of the students to communicate their science is adequately taught. I've edited people's theses for them, and they're terribly written, and nobody cares. Nobody's really asking them to write. And if you think about it, you spend however many years with your nose to the bench doing research, and then you're suddenly supposed to be able to write about it coherently. They're not the same skills. And I don't know, maybe things have changed because it was a little while ago that I did this, but I didn't get any instruction in that. I happened to love writing, and so I took to it really well. And then I enjoyed helping other people to improve their skills at it. But nobody, like, I kind of stepped up to do that for the more junior members of my lab. But nobody had that responsibility, and nobody was making sure that those students were getting that help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, you and I know how that life is hard, and I have some admiration, you know, for people who are doing research every day and discovering things that help humanity, let's say. But all that pressure to publish, to the thing about principal investigators to do administrative tasks, to there's also, I would say, some, you know, some challenge on their part. And not all of them have all the skills or resources to then also play the mentor role to their underlings, let's say.
And to be fair, I don't know how much help they get developing those skills. I mean, hopefully some, but if you think about the skills that it takes to get those fantastic publications, which are kind of the primary requirement to get a professor position, they're not the same skill that it takes to coach people who are, you know, maybe feeling demotivated or lacking direction. And in fact, you might enrich the other way. The guy who's spending every Saturday night in the lab churning out great data may not actually have the best social skills. So, you know, it's true. It's I think that it's a lot to ask of professors as well to have all of those skills.
Definitely. There are depending on where people are studying, there's systems, there's like committees that are part of some PhD programs where the person gets in the program and starts their PhD, and they have a committee that's composed of different principal investigators from different labs. And I think that in that, you know, because the student is not faced only with their supervisor, they have other people with whom they meet regularly. That's already a type of system that must help a lot.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that more and more institutions are recognizing the need for that and putting those sorts of things into place. And I think it's really positive. And I think that it's the right direction to go. I hope that that really continues, and that what I'm describing is not recognizable to some of the people who'll hear this.
Yeah, and that there's instead of less funding for science, that there's more and more, and that the pressure goes down a little bit, so that people can more easily, go into science, and thrive in science. And now we were talking about the academic setting. What about in your current career, or since you left academia, did you have mentors that helped you become who you are today professionally?
Yeah, well, for sure. I think any time that you go into a new direction, you have to be, you benefit from the attitude that you're going to learn from everybody that's around you. So, you know, when I first stepped out of academia into education communication, I was learning from everybody. And I think I still am. And I think that's a good way to approach any kind of work. I think in terms of like a more philosophical mentor, I'm going to go back to the hockey world. I was completely outside of the science and medical education, but I'm really inspired by the GM of Les Canadiens, Mike Ewings, and by Caroline Ouellette, who was the captain of Team Canada at Sochi, and she's a, you know, multiple Olympian, a terrific person. The two of them, they both have such vision and such drive for what they're doing. They'll rise above petty setbacks and frustration, and they will take on any challenge to move their vision forward. And they don't limit themselves. You know, they don't stop at an obstacle. They just find creative solutions and keep moving things forward. It's a little bit different to you know, that's not somebody who's necessarily showing you how to edit or showing you how to develop e-learning modules. But you can learn those things from your colleagues and from various sources. But that attitude and that approach to things of believing in yourself and believing in what you're trying to do, and then being prepared to do whatever you need to, find whatever creative solution you can. And, you know, to take the setbacks, because women's hockey is an area where there is a lot of challenge. And there are setbacks. And I mean, we've just seen our entire league disappear. And to take those setbacks and not let them get you down. Like, you live them, you mourn them, but you move on. And you know, you're confident that what you believe in is bigger than that. And you find ways to keep going. And you believe that you've got something substantial to contribute. And you share that enthusiasm with others and move forward with them. I think those two really inspire me to do that in all the areas of my life.
Excellent. And so I was going to ask you what the most important lesson was that you learned from your mentors. From what all you said, I feel that it's this power, this attitude of resilience. Is there another lesson that you can share that has really, let's say, changed you and made you who you are today from your mentors?
I think it's like you said, the resilience, and it's also that personal responsibility, that feeling of it's my life. I'm the one living it. I'm responsible for making it something worth living. And of course, we all have doubt, but you can't let those doubts prevent you from doing something worthwhile and going for it. I mean, the worst that will happen is that it doesn't work out. But if you don't try, you let yourself down. So I think it's that feeling, because I think I did feel for a while during my academic experience, like, oh, poor me, you know, I'm not happy. Well, no one else is going to do anything about that. And no one else should. It's up to you. It's up to me. And that's both heavy and liberating. And when you can feel it as a liberation, like, okay, I can do whatever I want. It's up to me. Then it's kind of empowering as well. And that gives you a chance to take the direction that's going to, maybe it's going to be the right one. And yeah, I think it's that feeling of you've got to be responsible for yourself. It means you hold yourself to account to yourself, but it also means you're free to go in the direction that makes sense to you.
I totally agree with you. You can kind of get lost in this habit of self-pity, but it's just a break that's preventing you from going forward and higher.
Yeah, and the only person who's going to lose out from that is you. You know, you can say, "Oh, but I this and this stacked up against me." That's true, and you know, I'm not saying that people don't have difficult circumstances, for sure. And there are things that, you know, you can't get over. You can't. But you can look at your own situation and look for your own strengths and your own opportunities and find a way to go for something that you believe is worthwhile. I guess that's the other thing that's just always been super important to me, is that I've got to feel like what I'm doing is worthwhile. And I think that's probably the case for a lot of people who are starting out in research. They do it because they want to contribute something. They want to feel that what they're doing is worthwhile. But there are lots of ways to do that. Research is not the only way to do that. And that is very freeing as well. There's lots of opportunities to take your abilities and contribute them positively to society. And it's just a question of, you know, opening up to all these possibilities and going looking for them and not being afraid to look in unexpected directions.
You take the leap of faith?
Yeah, or even, you know, sometimes before we leap, we have to just look up. We've got our eyes so close to the ground or so close to the vent. And, you know, we don't know what else is out there. And there's all kinds of things out there. And I mean, for me, it was very much the case that I had no idea what I was looking for. I could not, 10 years ago, have named the position I have now. I knew what I wanted to do. I had no idea what that was. And it took years for it to appear. But just having become aware of that drive in me and that interest, then I started looking for it. And I started, and I kind of researched different things and, you know, came across different ideas and started going in a couple of different directions. But I think you have to be also patient with yourself. You can't expect it to be something like you're going to wake up tomorrow and go, that's it. You're going to be a chef. Decided. You kind of, you know, give yourself a chance. Give yourself some time. Give yourself an opportunity to look at different things, right? Maybe a few different things. And also to enjoy yourself along the way. I think I do very much believe in that. You work very hard and make some sacrifices, and sometimes you go through some tough things for a long-term goal that is worth it. But we have to be careful not to get so caught up in that that we don't enjoy now, because now is really all we've got. And, you know, we work hard during our undergraduate so that we can get a good graduate position, work hard during our graduate studies to get a good postdoc. But somewhere along the way, you've got to start enjoying yourself. And, you know, when you realize that everybody else gets to enjoy themselves, why shouldn't you? So then you've got to find your own opportunity to do that.
Yeah, or else we just, each time we hit a milestone, we just take the goalpost and put it 10 yards farther.
Yeah. And that will go on forever, you know, and then you're going to try and get a junior position, and then you're going to try to work towards tenure, and nobody gets tenure these days anyway. Like, if your happiness is contingent on achieving something, like, far away, and everything you're doing to try to get there you can't enjoy, that's really not a good setup.
Those are very, very wise words, it's perfect, because we're reaching the end of the interview, and I feel this is setting a very good tone to my last question, and I feel that it's, you know, very valuable and very wise advice to our listeners. Today is all you have. You live today, and you do live for tomorrow. But again, like you were saying, if you're putting the objective always farther away, you know, you may find it difficult to enjoy today and to thrive in your daily life.
Yeah, and you have the right to enjoy every day. And I think we can get so caught up in that, oh, I've got to sacrifice now for later, that we kind of miss that. You can enjoy every day, or you have a right to be happy. I think during my postdoc, some of that time was really tough. And I started it with just taking little moments and saying to myself, okay, in this moment, I am happy. And I'm actually walking home in the sunshine, and it was beautiful in that moment. But by identifying those moments and saying, right now, I'm happy, I kind of had little micro moments, and then they expanded, it got a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. And as you're identifying the things that make you happy, then you seek them out more. And that helps you also maybe to shift your focus and see if you are happy and you're in the lab and you're developing a film and you're seeing a result for the first time, and that's making you super happy, that's telling you something. But if you're happy when you're out playing hockey, or when you're editing a paper for a friend, or when you're in the schools doing, you know, purifying DNA from banana for the 600th time, that's telling you something too. And you have to listen to yourself on that.
Well, that's... That's going to be the golden nugget for your show notes, for sure. So I'm going to go to my last question, which is a little bit of a wrap up of all we've been talking about. You know, I didn't have to ask you a lot of questions. You covered a lot of the points that I usually like to cover, and it was great. So the last question. Usually I say it's kind of a role play type thing where you're going to imagine yourself to be in a situation. And the situation is, imagine that you're standing in front of an audience full of young, either finalists or young graduates, people just like you when you finished your studies, and people who are struggling through fears, worries, doubts, and they're dealing with obstacles to find their place in the job market, to trace their journey towards a productive and fulfilling life. Looking at these people, what two or three basic strategies or principles could they follow starting today to put in place a realistic and attainable transition project from their academic life to their life in non-academic?
Wow, that's a big challenge. It's a big question. I think try and stick to two or three points. I think one is really what I've come back to quite a few times. That personal responsibility. It's your future, and it's your life right now. It's up to you to be happy, do things that make you happy, and you deserve to be happy. You don't have to sacrifice your happiness for some greater good. You have every right to be happy. In terms of, that's kind of a philosophical kind of overriding principle. I think in terms of thinking that you'd kind of like to maybe try something outside of academia, I would encourage, if at all possible, to finish the degree you're working on, because I think if you'll feel good about it, I think it'll help you to put a good foot forward saying, well, I've done that, I've succeeded at that, that was something I could do. And I think that it has a lot of value, whether employers recognize it or not, it does have a lot of value, and it makes you a much more capable person. And I think you want to recognize what you're taking out of those degrees and what else you are as a person. So if you're doing research, I think that the two top things that are transferable from that are your critical thinking skills and your ability to take a big project, break it into pieces, analyze those, get those done, tie them back together, and bring them back to the whole. I think you can do that, and pretty much anyone doing research is doing that. Then you can do anything. You can take on any kind of challenge. So then it's finding, where do you want to put your energy? What are you passionate about? I know they say, you know, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. Well, whatever. You still have to work. It's not always fun. And not everybody gets to work doing what they love. But there's got to be something that you're doing or that you wish you could do that draws you. And I think you kind of just need to let yourself start exploring that patiently, giving yourself some time. You don't have to make an immediate jump into your forever job. Kind of look around you, see what's out there without too much pressure on yourself. And you probably will find there's a direction you'd kind of like to go. Maybe you could get some initial experience as a volunteer or doing some kind of work with somebody on something that is maybe more like a hobby or more like an interest. And you may find that kind of opens up into opportunities. And there you can apply your ability to take a big project, tear it down and get it done and build it back up again. So I would like to encourage people who are maybe struggling towards the end of their graduate studies to believe in themselves, to recognize they have a lot of skill, they're capable of a lot, and they have a right to do something that makes them really happy. Finish up those degrees, open up your eyes, look around, and start trying to feel your way out into something that you want to spend your time doing.
Well, thank you very much, Fiona. It's been great interviewing you. I think you've given insights that are going to be inspiring to a lot of our listeners, and that are going to maybe help them allow themselves to look up and to see a bright future in front of them, and a future that will give them fulfillment and happiness.
Thank you. That's very kind. I really do hope that there's that message is in there somewhere.
I believe it is, and I thank you. I thank you again for having accepted my invitation. So thank you so much, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another Beyond the Thesis conversation with me, David Mendez, and my guest, Jessica Schleider. If you'd like to support the show and help me produce more interviews like this, just go to papaphd.com/PayPal and donate there. And if you want to help a little bit more, please go to papaphd.com/audience and fill in the survey that is there for you and leave a comment so I can give you a shout out in a future episode. Thank you for being a fan, happy listening, and happy sharing.